Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in top 10 lists. That's what we're doing today. No controversies and controversies. Folks, we are here in the first week in February. So you know what that means. It's finally time for our annual top 10. Here's the thing. I have a really strong opposition to these outlets and individuals who post their top 10s on like the last week of November, the first week of December. I think that's nonsense. There's a whole month left. You got to give people time to see things. If you want to have a full discussion, you got to give folks time to catch up. So that's why we're doing this now.
Next year, we're going to do it, I guess, this year. This year is next year.
I can't say we'll do it like this all the time.
Next year, we're going to do it in October.
This is how it worked out for this year's scheduling purposes. We're doing it in the first week of February. So I hope everybody has been on tenterhooks waiting for this because it's finally here. Even with the delay, you know, some of the movies that came out this year, we just haven't seen. We don't have time for it. There's like 5,000 movies that come out every year. They come out on all the streaming services and theaters. So, things slip by. For instance, next week, I think we're going to be talking about I'm Still Here, which is a Best Picture nominee that I don't think any of us have seen yet. So, you know, maybe that will end up on a retrospective list in the future. Who can say?
That's what we should actually do, is make our lists at the end of the following year.
We should do what your colleague Jesse does and do like a 5 year after the fact. Like here are the
I think he's doing them
lasted?
Like not 5 years. I think he does them like 20 years later.
Yeah, it's like 10 or 20 years. He's got a whole thing.
He's in like the best of 2004 at this point.
We're not doing that anyway. I'll say before we get started on this is that it feels like it's been a relatively weak year for movies. Unlike past years where it felt like there was something that was like. There wasn't just 10 really great movies. There was stuff that was like, this is possible. Best of the decade, you know, stuff, Oppenheimer, Tar, et cetera, et cetera. This year just felt like a lot of, I'll put it this way. There's a lot of stuff that's good that I really enjoyed that I liked on certain levels, but there was very little I saw this year that was like, this is probably best of the decade contending material. We'll see. I don't know. Again, things change. As time goes on, maybe it grows in estimation, et cetera, et cetera. With no further ado, we'll get to the list. If you're a reader of my newsletter, you're probably not going to see too many surprises here, but I'm very curious to see what Peter and Alyssa's lists look like. We haven't discussed this at all, so I'm getting all of this information at the same time as you guys are. I mean, well, technically like a day ahead because we tape and then this isn't a live show, you know, but hey, you know what I mean.
I'm also excited to find out what my list is. I may be finding out at the same time that Sonny does.
As always, we'll count down from 10. I don't know why this is so complicated for Peter in particular. I feel like he's always wanting to be like, wait, do we start at one and then count? I don't know.
We're not doing that. Never asked that.
10. 9, 8, et cetera, et cetera. We're going down. We count down on this show. So I'll start. I'll go first. Number 10, I have a two-way tie for 10th. I'm pulling in Alyssa. There's going to be a lot of two-way ties on this list, perhaps. Maybe I'm the only one who does it this year. I don't know. But my at number 10 for me, two-way tie, Megalopolis and Horizon, an American Saga, Part 1. There's two mad works of semi-deranged genius from two of our greatest older living filmmakers, right? These are both bloated movies, undeniably bloated, undoubtedly excessive, completely unique in the face of so much modern slop, though. And I feel like we need to pay tribute to our elder statesmen of cinema who pour their own money into realizing massive visions of filmic excess. We're too spoiled. We look at these gifts from Francis Ford Coppola and we say, oh, do better. Streamline it. Make it more accessible to me, the mass audience. No, sir. No. I will never punish a filmmaker for overreaching, unlike the rest of you out there. So many haters and doubters on this show and elsewhere. I don't know. Alyssa, what is your number 10?
I had a really, really hard time making this list because I don't really think I have a top 10 movies this year or the number of movies that I have, even in the top five, that has substantial flaws is considerable. But my 10th is Furiosa, A Mad Max Saga, a movie I wanted to like more than I did, but that I think is still has a bunch of excellent performances in it. And I just really respect George Miller's, you know, long-term commitment to building out this world in a way that, you know, even though trends in apocalyptic fiction have changed a lot over time, never ceases to feel sort of fresh and revelatory. And I liked it a lot.
I'll say the thing about Furiosa that has surprised me in a lot of the award season chatter is just how little play. Like, I'm not saying like Chris Hemsworth should have been nominated for Best Supporting Actor, though we probably should have, because that's a great performance. But like no special effects nominations, no sound nominations. I was kind of surprised by that at the Oscars. It feels like a movie that has been a little bit forgotten, which again is surprising considering how beloved Mad Max Fury Road was and continues to be. A little disappointing for them, I'm sure. Peter, what is your number 10?
Well, for number 10, for the 10 slot, I almost had five movies, and I decided to cut it down to three. Three movies that I think are thematically linked in a certain way. Three really good, modestly but not tiny budgeted horror films, all of which I think work really well on their own terms and are actually just really well directed. These are examples of films where you can just see that whatever issues you might have with the script or the story or the concept, the directors are really working hard and doing great work. And those three movies are Late Night with the Devil, Long Legs, and Smile 2. And I don't know that we have talked about any of those on this podcast, in part because we don't always do horror here, but I just thought that all three of those films were, they're not quite truly great movies, but they're really well-made smaller films by younger up-and-coming directors. And I would particularly pull out Smile 2 as being exceptionally well-directed, a movie that just doesn't in any way need to be interesting, it doesn't need to show off, and yet the director just comes in and moves the camera in ways that are fascinating. That movie is staged just, right up to the point of death. I mean, the mise-en-scene in that film, a mise-en-scene? I can never pronounce the French there. But just the staging and choreography and camera work is really exceptional in that movie.
Interesting. I'll talk a little more about Long Legs later. And Smile 2, I liked, though my problem with both the Smile movies is that given that the whole like shtick of this thing is like it's taking place entirely in the victim's head, means they can do anything. And once you start losing rules, it like, I don't know, I like rules. I need rules in my horror movies. That's my big takeaway from those. All right. Number nine. Another two-way tie. Look, I know how ties on lists work. You can't have a two-way place at nine and then have a two-way tie at 10th. That doesn't make any sense, but I'm doing it. It's my list. I'll do what I want. I have another tie. I'm going with Last Stop in Yuma County and Strange Darling. If Megalopolis and Horizon are like auteurist excess, right, big, bloated, spectacle type things that we're celebrating, then I would also like to celebrate the budget constrained auteurist self-control of Last Stop in Yuma County and Strange Darling, which are very much spiritual heirs to Tarantino in his early 90s phase, though very different modes. Last Stop in Yuma County is kind of the hard-boiled, grindhousey, Reservoir Dogsy, violent sort of Tarantino, whereas
Strange
Darling
really feels like Oliver Stone's U-Turn, which was in some ways a kind of Tarantino-ish film, but very
sure
similar idea.
Sure. And also Strange Darling, which does the kind of out of sync chronology sort of thing very well, that, you know, Tarantino played and plays around a lot with. So I like both those movies. They kind of fit together on my list, so I put them both at number nine. Sue me. Stop me from doing it. You can't. Alyssa, what is your number nine?
In a two-way tie, I am putting Hitman and the Fall Guy. For, you know, the sort of easy romantic chemistry in both of them, slightly high concept, but mostly just like delightful, loose rom-com at the movie stops, and we need more of that. I think both are flawed movies in some ways, The Fall Guy in particular, which, and I think it's, to a certain extent, I may be cheating a little bit because I enjoyed the chemistry between the stars so much on that movie. You really should not make a movie about stunts where the stunts don't look that great. But, you know, Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt get a lot of points together. And we need more movies about adult courtship. It's, you know, it's an important subject, and rom-coms are good.
Fair. That's all fair. Peter, what is your number nine?
Like you, I also had Strange Darling at number nine. It's just a really sharply paced film. It does the out of order, out of sync, you know, Reservoir Dogs, Inglourious Bastards, Tarantino thing better than almost any non-Tarantino movie that I can think of. And it's also thematically subversive in ways that I don't quite want to spoil for listeners here, but I think it takes some of the kind of, I don't quite want to say Me Too, but sort of gender politics and gender culture war themes that we have seen discussed that have become sort of hot topics of conversation over the past decade or so, and does some unusual and unexpected and even a little bit daring things with them.
I have so many thoughts in this vein that I also don't want to spoil for people, so I will keep them to myself. I will say that I know there are some folks, so the way the film is structured is it's five chapters or six chapters or something like that.
And I believe an epilogue.
And it starts on chapter three, like the title, you know, it's like, and it does this, and I have screenwriter friends who always get kind of annoyed by this in media res sort of thing. They're like, oh, they're just putting it because they can't figure out how to start it, blah, blah, blah. But I actually, and also they say, oh, well, come on, you know, they're just doing this so they can set up. But like, if you understand anything about movies, you understand that they're doing the in media res thing as a misdirect. And then you start thinking about what the misdirect must be. And you kind of can figure it out as you go. Even having figured it out, even like figuring it out in like the opening 30 seconds, what is actually happening in this movie, it still worked for me. And that's a testament to the picture and the performances, I would say. All right, number eight, I have Between the Temples, which is, it's just an odd little relationship comedy. I don't think a lot of people saw it, which is too bad, but it has two of my favorite performances of the year, one from Jason Schwartzman and the other from Carol Kane. I always love seeing Schwartzman pop up and stuff. He's been one of my favorite actors ever since Rushmore. I love seeing him in things. He has a very small part in Gia Coppola's The Last Showgirl, which is like that movie was getting a lot of awards buzz for Pamela Anderson. And I did not understand why, because she's not, frankly, not very good in the movie. The movie itself is very fine. She's okay in it, but not, you know, I didn't think awards worthy. Demi Moore does the whole, like, I am a longtime actress who never quite got the due she deserved because I was seen solely as a sex symbol thing down. Anyway, I'm rambling here, but the point is Jason Schwartzman has like a 5-minute scene in this movie and just steals the whole movie. It's great. He's very, very good in it. And he's also very, very good in Between the Temples, which I think is on Netflix now. People should check it out if they haven't seen it. Alyssa, what is your number eight?
Conclave, a movie that is impeccably made until a final sort of 15 minutes that makes no sense and doesn't work. it is a sort of rigorously beautiful movie. It is just without flaw in the acting, I think. Isabella Rossellini as a barely speaking nun who, you know, kind of, it is wonderfully made. And I understand sometimes when you're adapting a book, you stick with the twist in the book. And I admit that I cannot think of necessarily a sort of a better or cleaner way for Conclave to have ended. But it's a impeccable and flawed movie all at once. I think Stanley Tucci is really, really wonderful in it. And it is, you know, Catholicism is sort of frequently adopted as a movie backdrop, treated in a conspiratorial way, but a movie that is just, you know, interestingly engaged with both sort of clashes in the church, what happens when, you know, a European institution goes global and the, you know, its European origins sort of start to decline. Like, what is the church going to be? You know, if this had ended, if the movie had ended in a way that didn't feel ridiculous, I think it probably would have been in my top five.
Conclave is fascinating. I can't remember if I have already mentioned this on the show, but I saw Conclave in a theater with a normal paying audience. And when the big reveal in the last 10 minutes or so happened, people were literally scoffing. And like, there was like a, I think somebody said, "Are you kidding me?" Something like that. It was a fascinating reaction. I'm glad I saw that one with a real audience instead of a bunch of critics. Eight, Peter.
The Substance. It's stylish. It's incredibly rigorously constructed. I mean, the opening shot and the final shot just sort of match each other in reverse in really nice ways. The arc, the sort of three-act structure of this movie is just impeccable. And every single shot is just kind of fascinatingly like precise and stylish. It's also freaking bonkers. It's so crazy. And I love how crazy it is because it manages to be totally crazy in this incredibly controlled, stylish way. I think there's a way in which like people are very into this movie because of the thematic stuff, right? Because it's this, you know, sort of like quite kind of nutso satire about aging and, you know, female bodies in Hollywood. And I think the movie does that stuff pretty well, but it's just doing more than that. It's doing like, it's not just about that. There's something else there. Like the movie is also just about like the kind of the bizarro freakish insanity of all Hollywood and of all performance and of putting your body on screen and making that your life. And it does this through the lens of the experience of a female actress, for sure. And like, that's, I don't want to say it's not talking about that. Like, that's very much the subject of the movie. But this movie is even more than that. It's just about like how Hollywood is an absolute like bonkers freak show in a way that I really liked, especially since it demonstrates such a command of filmmaking and of craft and style.
Well, The Substance is, I've said this before, The Substance is much more interesting as a movie about addiction than it is about the gender roles in Hollywood. It's much more interesting on that level, I think. And it reveals itself a little more deeply if you look at it on that level, because as you mentioned, it's a little, there's a lot of surface level stuff happening that is fine, but very surface level. And this
there's
is,
also, I mean, a kind of non-gendered way to look at the movie, not as about addiction, but as just about aging and the desire to hang on to your former self, which I don't know, maybe has a little bit of relevance in America in the year of 2024 that we just went through.
I wouldn't know what you're talking about. All right. At number seven, I have Dune Part Two, which I got, people yelled at me. They're like, "That's so low. How can you put it so low? It's too low." And Peter will probably say, "That's too low. It's too low. Honestly, looking, I think it might be too high, frankly, after having sat with this list for a couple of weeks. I look, movie has some great moments. Very nice on the big screen. Very loud. Some nice compositions. That whole middle hour is a slog. I honestly cannot imagine sitting back and watching this. The first one I rewatched a couple times because it has some great moments. It's got some big stirring, and this one just doesn't. It doesn't have that. And maybe, look, honestly, maybe I just resent this movie because it made me confront the fact that Timothée Chalamet is in fact a legit star. And I hate that movie. I hate this movie for that. How dare it make me admit this? Screw you.
The whole middle hour is just Javier Bardem being funny MAGA Timothy Chalamet uncle.
No.
That's, yeah, it's great.
There's all that stuff with the Harkonnens that doesn't work at all. It doesn't. It's the blech. That's the other problem. This movie doesn't really have a villain. All right. Alyssa, number 7.
Timothée Chalamet is the villain.
Well, yes, also that. A tie between September 5th and Saturday Night. Two small, sort of rigorously made, extremely well acted movies that are about the process of making decisions and frequently and making decisions under pressure, right? They're movies about media and sort of iconic moments in media, the birth of the, you know, long-running, now 50 years old, you know, live variety show on NBC, and the never to be repeated, you know, live broadcast of the Black September attack on the Munich Olympics. But they are really about sort of how you make up your mind in a tense, time-limited situation with imperfect information and enormous pressure. And, you know, I have talked about sort of John Magaro a lot on this podcast over the years, and he has just become one of those actors, I think really since Past Lives, who I will just watch in absolutely anything. And, you know, I think the lead performance in Saturday Night is quite good. I think his performance in September 5th is outstanding.
I really like this pick. I really like this pairing, too, Alyssa. They were both kind of on the edge for me. And I like it, especially because these movies have both been getting attacked for different reasons, I think very unfairly by some in the, I don't know, some in the critical community. There's definitely a lot. But I am pro both of those movies. Good pick. Peter, what is your number 7 spot?
Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, a Mad Max story, whatever it is. I like that movie a lot. I saw it only one time in the theater. Had some personal stuff, kept me out of the movie theater, but it's a movie I wanted to go back and see again, almost immediately. And I've watched it several times at home since. It's just big and loud, but also tender and beautiful in a way that we know that George Miller can be, but that Fury Road was not necessarily. I think Fury Road ultimately is a better film. It looks better. It's cleaner. It's simpler. But this is a great sort of coda or asterisk filling out, a fleshing out of the world of Fury Road. And it is, it's also, I think it's a more mature film, and also, and a movie that more reflects, I think, sort of what George Miller really wants to put into the world. Not like I think he doesn't like Fury Road and isn't proud of it. This is the guy who made, the original Mad Max films when he was young. He likes this stuff. He's into crashing cars into each other, but he has some other stuff he wants to say about the, what it is to be a person and to have meaning and purpose in a cruel and strange world.
What does it mean to be a person in a cruel and strange world? I don't know. All right, wouldn't number know. 6. I have Anora at number 6. I think it's by far the best of the movies nominated for Best Picture. It's what I would vote for if I were in the Academy. This also means it stands no chance, probably, but, you know, that's okay. I'm excited to revisit this one once it hits the Criterion Collection later this year. They're putting out a 4K for it. Very, very excited. I'm sure it'll be great. And I'm glad that it's a critical and it's a very successful movie critically. It's a modestly successful movie commercially. And hopefully that means Sean Baker, who is one of our most interesting filmmakers, I think, gets to continue making this sort of movie, which again is like it's a very weird movie. Speaking of middle hours that kind of go on forever, but I liked the fact that this middle hour went on forever. It was an odyssey through the heart of, you know, New York City that is what I imagine people who really love John Cassavetes love about those movies. I've never really got, I don't like, I watch John Cassavetes movies and I like kind of zone out and futz out. My brain just doesn't work for them. But this really did, I thought. And I enjoy it. And I look forward to revisiting it again sometime soon.
There's also a depth to those characters and performances that resembles early Scorsese and P.T. Anderson. Like they're sort of comic but tragic, and you just sort of they're totally and fully realized.
Yes, agreed. Alyssa, number six.
A Quiet Place Day One, which, yeah, I thought you guys would be surprised about this, but Lupita Nyong'o's performance in this is one of my favorite of the year. She is, you know, sort of raw and unpleasant and funny, and the portrait of someone behaving what we would think of as sort of irrationally in the middle of an apocalypse is actually, I think, one of the most sort of sharply observed and humane of these kinds of movies. The idea, you know, there is such a tendency to, you know, treat people effectively as ants in these kinds of movies, as motivated sort of only by the survival instinct. And the idea that, you know, someone might see the apocalypse as an opportunity not to cling to life, but for a good death is in some ways so sort of deeply moving. That final sequence has just stuck with me all year. You know, I think it is just a tremendously alive movie about mass death. And I just think it's kind of wonderful.
Yeah, I was a little bit surprised to hear that one, frankly. But that's I think that's very compellingly argued. Peter, number six.
Challengers. It's a hoot. I don't even like tennis, but I love the go for broke filmmaking here. Just that this is a movie that could have been really staid and boring and just kind of bland. And instead, it is just an absolute pleasure to watch Luca how do you pronounce his last name?
Guadagnino.
Guadagnino's camera move. It's so full of energy and life and also sensuality and a kind of real, raw, like uncut sense of like, man, bodies. Whew. There's like, right, like movies have really, especially in the superhero era, have pulled off of this idea, have backed away from this idea that people are hot, that people have desire, that people are desirable, and Challengers just makes so much out of that. It is a movie, sure, it's about tennis, but really it's about bodies and desire, and we don't have enough of those movies, and we certainly don't have enough of them that are made this well. Also has the very best score of the year and maybe of the decade, even though we're only halfway through, by Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails.
It is a very good movie about tennis, particularly the mental aspects of tennis. It really captures that perfectly. At number five, I have Red Rooms, which is a French-Canadian film about the horrors of social media and the sociopathy of the web. No idea why that sort of thing is interesting at this time in our collective history, when there's just videos of people getting murdered constantly on social media, like straight up snuff films. I think it's bad. I think it's bad for society. And I think this movie does a very good job of capturing how that sort of thing captures and transforms individuals in weird and deforming and bad ways. We are a fallen and sick people, and the web is really amplifying it in ways that are destructive and bad. So I don't know how to fix it. I don't think you can, because the problem is people. Alyssa, number five.
Civil War, which is a movie that I liked much less than the two of you when we first saw it, not least because I'm still so bothered by the idiocy of the, like, you get one question to ask the dictatorial president of the United States before he's executed, and that's what you ask? Good God. But that movie, just moment by moment, in its sense of profound unease, has lingered with me and grown on me. It is perhaps the most I never want to watch this movie ever again movie that I now really want to watch again. And it's just beautiful, man. It is, you know, it is beautiful in its ugliness. And I am really, really curious to see what Garland does with this movie, Warfare, that he is co-directing, that's out this year.
What you say about the journalist is interesting. And I think part of what is interesting about this movie is that I think people... I think a large number of people accepted at face value Alex Garland's statements that this movie is a love letter to journalists, and I do not think it is that.
He definitely felt like he needed to say that, though.
This movie is very much about the kind of thrill junkie nature of a lot of journalists and journalism, but maybe we'll discuss more in a bit. Peter, number five.
Rebel Ridge, Jeremy Saulnier's public policy action movie. It's a civil asset forfeiture film in the style of Rambo, and it's awesome. I loved it. I've seen this movie three times. I'm excited to watch it again. It's just such a rare thing to see a film like this, which is just a straightforward middle budget. I think they made it for like $20 or $25 million streaming first. Just kind of a, you know, contemporary revenge film about a guy who got wronged by a couple of local cops. Okay, we've all seen that movie a bunch of times, but you've never seen it quite like this. I loved the action choreography. I loved just the kind of confident containment of the two lead performances, which are not showy. It's not a lot of showy acting, but they're both just these really quietly engaging and gripping lead performances. And I just loved that he was like, yeah, you know what would really make somebody like feel like they just needed to get back at the local cops? If they took all their stuff and it was legal, which it is, it's a problem. Civil asset forfeiture. Google it, folks. Bad.
This movie was right on the edge for me, too, and I just couldn't quite get it to fit in my list how I wanted to make it.
You just put it in the number one.
I left it off, but it's very good. I guess my biggest concern with it was, you know, it is like 40 minutes too long, probably. Maybe like 30 minutes too long. It's too long. Too long movie. Should have been shorter, tighter, more little more brutal. All right, number four. I have Long Legs, which is a movie. You know, we talk about how movies are marketed sometimes on this show, and I think this movie was marketed pretty well because it was successful. People went to go see it, but also like kind of deceptively, because I think folks went in expecting a Silence of the Lambs, like procedural FBI thriller type movie, and this is a straightforwardly supernatural film involving like Satan, telepathy, evil dolls, etc. Like it is not Silence of the Lambs at all. That is a gross, you know, kind of mischaracterization of the film on the behalf of the marketers. But that's neither here nor there. I liked it a lot. I liked watching it in a movie theater where the sound was totally surround, you know, immersive, and I love the lingering shots in this movie that use negative space behind characters to emphasize the fact that when your back is turned, you are exposed. You are exposed to danger. So put your back against a wall at all times. You go to a restaurant, you sit against that corner wall. Don't leave yourself open. All right, Alyssa, number four.
Dune Part Two. Which I think I fall somewhere in between you and Peter on that movie. It is very loud. It is very well acted. There are places where it is maybe a little bit slower than it needs to be, and the Harkonnens like don't kind of get to be people. But the early sequence from the movie with a bunch of soldiers sort of floating up in, you know, in a, not tandem, that's the wrong word, floating up in this eerie line
formation
from the sand to the top of a sort of rock formation to get away from a sandworm, is just one of the eeriest, most memorable images from movie going in the past year for me. And I think it, you know, that sense of strangeness is pervasive in the movie in a way that most sort of science fiction doesn't really actually manage to pull off. That sense that you are living in an entirely different universe from the one that is available to you. Timothée Chalamet is a star, Zendaya is a star, Javier Bardem and Rebecca Ferguson are just both freaking great. I will watch these movies until the end of time, especially having sort of slogged my way through Dune Prophecy, which I thought was not great.
I watched one episode of Dune Prophecy and I was like, this is not very good. And then I literally never thought about it again. I like, it's one of these shows where I would have forced myself to like keep going if I had remembered that it was still on, and I totally forgot. And I was just like, I'm not catching up. I refuse. I refuse to do that to myself. Peter, what's your number four?
Anora. I really liked this movie. It is just, like I said, it's so full of life, and it's such a great movie about a particular place and a particular cultural milieu, but not just one type of sort of one person stuck in that milieu or one group. It is about the clash and the bumping up of all of these different types of people who live in this area of Brooklyn together, right? And it's just this great little slice of Americana that is both sad and tragic in so many ways, but also this is a movie that could so easily have just been grim and bleak about working class exploitation and Russian billionaires who rule all and don't care about people. And this movie has that. It's sad and bleak at times, but it's funny, and it remembers and reminds you constantly that people are kind of wonderful and delightful, even when they're being crazy, even when they're being awful, even when they're being jerks, that everybody has multiple sides to them, that you can be the enforcer for a Russian billionaire. And also you can be kind of a nice and gentle and sensitive guy, and people can like a single human being can contain all of that. And a single movie can contain many, many, many sort of layered, stacked, like a prismatic sort of infinite mirror like version of all of those things. And it's just this great tour of a part of New York that most of us don't see, and a whole bunch of people in their lives.
At number three, I have The Beekeeper. Perfect movie. Perfect. It's a perfect movie. And when I say something is a perfect movie, I want to define my terms here. I don't mean it's like the greatest movie ever made. I don't even necessarily mean, you know, it's a 4-star movie, right? I mean that it's perfect in the sense that it sets out to do a thing and then it does that thing with absolute clockwork precision. In this case, the thing is Jason Statham beats up a bunch of people you hate. And it does it perfectly. It's got a lot of bee puns. You know how many other bee puns are in all of the rest of the movies we've mentioned today combined? Zero. Zero bee puns in those. The Beekeeper has dozens of bee puns, and it works. It works perfectly. It just is incredibly, incredibly satisfying. And it's incredibly satisfying because it has the most despicable villains on screen in film in 2024. I include the Harkonnens in that. The Harkonnens don't count because they barely have motivation. Gen Z scammers who prey on the elderly to drain their bank accounts. The worst people on earth. Literally the worst, absolute lowest scum of the earth, those people. Jason Statham tying one of them to a truck and running that truck off a bridge. Most satisfying sequence on film this year. Number three, The Beekeeper. Alyssa, what is your number three?
Challengers. Man, like, just the cinema of the body. It's great. Again, Zendaya's a star. Mike Faced is great. He gave one of those performances in West Side Story where I was immediately like, yes, I will watch you in just about anything. And watching Josh O'Connor go from like Uptight Prince Charles to sexy dirtbag tennis player is just a delightful transformation. Like the whole sequence in the hotel bar where he's like going on Tinder dates basically to have a place to sleep for the night, and where that fact is sort of revealed and he like lands the date anyway is just hilarious. But it's also just a really, as much as it's a movie about like hot people having sex, it's also just a movie about, you know, what happens when your body doesn't cooperate at the thing that you want it to do and sort of how wrenching that can be. Or alternatively, what happens when your body can do something really, really well that you just don't really want to do anymore. And so it is, yes, it's a movie about sex, but it's a movie about sort of individuals' relationships to their bodies. It's so funny. It's so hot. It's so sad. I loved it.
Dune 2. So when the first Dune came out, right around that time, there was a meme going around that was like a clipped from a political, like, know your politicians' positions paper thing, like a little guidebook, and it had Bernie Sanders and it had Joe Biden, and it was like, know your politicians on the issues, Dune. And Bernie Sanders is like, well, it's like a really complicated thing about environmental, and it just like keeps going on, right? Like, it's about, you know, sort of ecological, like, well, it's just like this whole long thing, like Bernie, like, it runs off the page, and then under Joe Biden's picture it just says, it's about worms. Guys, it's about worms. There's a bunch of stuff that happens in this movie, and a bunch, like, some themes about ecology and power seeking and all that. And I enjoyed it. But you know what it is? It's about worms. It's about giant worms and how big and awesome and loud they are. And I, like, it's the cinema of enormity. And this is what I love about Denis Villeneuve, is that he is the only person out there right now who is really trying to break the records for bigness, for, like, for scale, for showing us the thing that you genuinely have never seen before, or at least never seen it like that. And I just loved watching the big freaking worms do big freaking worm stuff for 2 hours and 42 minutes, four times in a movie theater. And I've seen it, I don't know, probably 8-10 times since.
That's too many times.
That's not enough.
At number two, I have Nosferatu. As I noted in my review, between this and The Witch and The Northman, writer-director Robert Eggers has created this whole body of work that basically accepts the moral landscape of its characters and dares to ask, like, what if mysticism and evil and the supernatural were real? How would a pre-scientific people respond to that? Which in turn causes us, the viewer, to ask, you know, what we have lost by rejecting this idea of inhuman supernatural evil. Also, just looks great. I love the look of this thing. It's my favorite looking movie of the year, just in terms of the shots in the darkness, and I think, you know, how everything is framed and how everything is lit, you know, mostly with either candles or torchlight. I think there's a little Day for Night in this, maybe, but it is it's just a great looking movie. It looks fantastic. Alyssa.
At number two, I have Anora, which I just found completely delightful and moving. You know, it's a riff on Pretty Woman, but it also is, you know, has just some elements of and wildness of a Buster Keaton movie. It's hot. It's sad. Mikey Madison is awesome in this. Like, I just, you know, there was a while on this podcast when we were sort of talking about, you know, like, where are the movie stars? And all of a sudden, I am just wildly excited about sort of the next 20 years of cinema involving, you know, Mikey Madison and Zendaya and Timothée Chalamet and Mike Faced. And, you know, I feel like the potential of acting has kind of opened up in front of me. And that was sort of the high point of movies this year for me, not in the sense that there were a ton of movies that blew me away or that I thought were going to be sort of all-time contenders, but that I felt like you could just sort of see the potential coming.
Peter.
At number two, I had Civil War. I really liked this movie, and I like it more, I think, the more I think about it. It is, like all of Alex Garland's films and books and scripts, it is a story about what happens when the normal order goes away. What do people do when they are left to kind of design a moral order for themselves? And so in his worldview, people are kind of animals. And there is always this sort of Hobbesian kind of jungle waiting out there for humanity. And he gives us different visions of that. And to tell the story through the lens of journalists here is a really fascinating choice, because there's a way in which he portrays journalists as amoral. But even more than that, I think he is suggesting, maybe not even suggesting, he's quite clearly saying that he thinks that journalism is contributing to the chaos, to the amorality, not just to the amorality, to the immorality, to the violence and the the sort of inhumanity, right? Because there's a little bit of the kind of the Tony Shalhoub monologue from The Man Who Wasn't There that I talked about, which talks about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but this idea that to observe something is to change it. You can't really see what would have happened had you not been there as the observer. You can only see what happens while you are there. And so you are changing the story in the midst of trying to document it, even if you think you are not, even if you are obeying strict rules. And so we are taken on this tour of a destroyed and broken America through through a group of journalists who are just trying to document the story, but they are part of it and they can't escape the fact that they are part of it. And they are part of this inhuman landscape of political and social division as much as anyone else who is carrying a gun.
I have at number one Civil War, which, it's an interesting movie because I have found that most of the people who don't like it because they wanted a different movie. They wanted a movie that put us inside, like, the actual Civil War and got to, like, root causes and, like, and they wanted a counterfactual breakdown of, like, how does America get to a place where Texas and California and Florida have kind of teamed up to, you know, go after the kind of MAGA coded, you know, guy in the White House. That all very much misses the point of the movie. They want a movie that's they want to be able to say this movie is good because it shows how bad the people I dislike are. That's not what the movie's up to. The movie is up to a very different and more specific thing. Which is basically about how sectarian war is driven by person-to-person grievances and resentments as much as anything else, which I think is an important thing to keep in mind for reasons that have nothing to do with anything that's going on. Alyssa, what did you have at number one?
The Brutalist. I think it is sort of, other than Anora, one of the very few movies this year likely to really stand the test of time. I think a movie that is, you know, without flaw. Peter, I think I mentioned this in our episode of The Brutalist. When we got out of it, he said it was sort of like the experience of, you know, what it must have been like to watch The Godfather on screen for the first time. And, you know, I need to sit with that assessment a little bit, but I think it is genuinely monumental, beautiful, remarkably acted, shot with verve. In its way, a really powerful movie for its moment in the sense that it's about being Jewish in America, in a way that avoids being bogged down in sort of cliche or the pre-existing lines of argument. It's a really impressive achievement.
Peter, what is your number one?
Also, The Brutalist. I think it's possible that I like this movie just a little bit less today than the day after I saw it. But I continue to think about this film quite a bit. It's the most distinctive film that I saw this year. And Civil War is a pretty damn distinctive movie, right? It's not like anything else you've seen before. But The Brutalist, even more so, is a movie that is just not like anything else I think I have ever seen before. I believe I said to Alyssa that it was a little like watching The Godfather at the intermission is I think when I said that I was trying to think of a comp for it. And I'm not sure that comparison holds up quite as much after the second half, though I believe I defended the second half as the kind of the payoff and the consequences of the first half. This is a movie that has a kind of mad ambition to it it's telling a story that I've never seen told and that I've never seen told this way. It is doing so in a style that is quite uniquely its own. And it uses elements from history, from character, from place, right? This sort of combination of specific, of unique and specific elements that I just don't, I can't think of anything that really matches it or sort of feels like this movie. And that's that, it, and it's, and at every moment, it's just incredibly well done. And that is something that you just don't get as a moviegoer very often, where like, I mean, if you listen to this podcast, you will hear me say very regularly, oh, this movie feels like X. It has this element that it has drawn from X. Oh, it has just that little bit there. Even if it's a fairly unique, you know, kind of film going experience, you can talk about the ways in which it is drawing from film history and from, you know, from other works. And it's not quite that there's literally nothing that I can compare The Brutalist to at all. But it's really hard to think of, what is this like? This is a wholly original work in a way that is so rare. And the fact that it's a wholly original 3.5-hour movie that transported me for the entire time. It's the best movie of the year. And it's the movie that I will think about. I will watch Dune 2 more times. I already have. But it's the movie that will probably occupy my kind of mind space about like what cinematic greatness is and could be more than any other this year.
The Brutalist is absolutely the best one half of one movie this year. All right, guys, good lists, everyone. These are I'll put the whole thing in like the first comment or something of the episode, just so it doesn't get spoiled in the body of the text. But I thought this is a pretty good lineup of movies here. Good lineup, guys. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. We're going to be talking about things that are actually in the movie theaters right now. It'll be fun. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.